What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Now look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Adam Kempinar.
And I'm Josh Larson.
So we made this oath. Whoever died first would send the other a sign.
A sign? From the afterlife?
You could call it that. You could call it a million things.
Kristen Stewart in a scene from Personal Shopper, the actress's second collaboration with French director Olivier Assayas. This one, an enigmatic reflection on loss and technology. Stewart, herself a bit of an enigma, with a cult of admirers that now extends beyond fans of her foray into blockbuster vampire movies.
We'll explore that enigma this week with our top five Stewart scenes, plus Film Spotting Madness Round 3 results and your Elite 8 matchups. What do you think? Is there an afterlife for the movies that get voted out of Film Spotting Madness? You know,
you'd
Jaws,
like to believe it.
Hanging out with the Raiders, maybe?
Nope, they're gone. They're gone forever, Josh.
It's all ahead on Film Spotting.
Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Film Spotting Madness Round 3 results coming later in the show, Josh. We had some blowouts and we had some tight races just like last week, but the tight ones, they weren't as close, nowhere as close, and the blowouts weren't as big. I don't know what that says about the matchups or the difficulty our listeners had in voting.
I can't wait to hear who won. I'm still in the dark, so I'm in suspense.
I love that. You just stay blissfully ignorant.
That's the best way to do it.
It's all really because you just want to be surprised, right, Josh, here on the show?
Yeah, and, okay. I want my responses and my voting to be instinctual.
Okay. 64 films we started with. We are going to be down to the Elite 8 after tonight. That does come later. As we said, our podcast listeners will get part 3 of our Agnes Varda marathon. We'll discuss Varda's 1977 feminist quasi-musical, One Sings, the Other Doesn't. And Josh and I, as promised, we will be sharing our top 5 Kristen Stewart scenes. But first, we wanted to bring someone in to talk about Personal Shopper, the new film starring Stewart from director Olivier Assayas. The pair had collaborated previously on 2015's Clouds of Sils Maria with Juliette Binoche. Stephen Cohn joins us now. He's a Chicago-based filmmaker and actor. He also teaches film acting at Northwestern University and the Acting Studio Chicago. His most recent film, Henry Gamble's Birthday Party, played the 2015 Chicago International Film Festival and opened in theaters last year to quite a bit of critical acclaim. Congratulations on that, Stephen. In a recent article he wrote for TalkHouse.com, Cohn wrote about the haunting effect the Personal Shopper had on him personally. Stephen Cohn, welcome back to Film Spotting.
Thanks for having me. This is fun.
Yeah, we did want to have you on after we saw your essay on Personal Shopper at TalkHouse, which was really wonderful, Stephen. I know because while I was reading it and then when I finished it, I was immediately jealous. That was a great piece of writing. So real fun to read. I want to give a little plot setup before I throw a question at you about Personal Shopper, though, for listeners who might not be familiar with it. But here Stewart plays the assistant of the title. She works for a private client in Paris. But the main narrative really has to do with this metaphysical presence that Maureen, the Stewart character, detects, and then her investigation into whether or not it might be the spirit of her recently deceased brother. Now, in your piece, Stephen, you wrote that the film treats creation as a spiritual act and cinema itself as seance. It is not a matter of the ghost being real or not. It's a matter of understanding that even the hardest skeptic lives with one foot inside of an imaginative plane of existence, a plane as legitimate as any other. Yeah, I love that. And in fact, I described a very different film somewhat similarly last year, Doctor Strange. I think there's actually some comparisons to be made between these two movies, but I'm not going to get into that now. I'm wondering if you could maybe expand on this notion of cinema as seance a little bit.
Yeah, well, first of all, I saw Personal Shopper a couple weeks ago, and I'm at the Siskel Center here in Chicago, and I'm a huge fan of Assayas, and a huge fan, a gigantic fan of Olivier Assayas, and I've been watching his stuff for 20 years. So I expected to like it. I didn't expect it to be one of the more vulnerable and moving experiences I've had in a movie theater in a long time. And I'm still, you know, it's an endlessly complex piece, and I'm still trying to figure out why exactly I was so touched. And I think in the Talk House piece, I get on these other couple of movies that have affected me similarly. And kind of, you know, one thing I talk about in the piece is that we love to throw around the word haunting. Like, everything's haunting. Mm-hmm. Everything's haunting. And if it's like softly spoken, or it's lyrical, or if it's about something poignant, then we consider that it's haunting. There was something really direct and private about this experience of watching this. I felt like the movie was speaking to me directly, not because of someone that I've lost, but in a really personal way that comes from, you know, deeply woven artistry that deals with these huge metaphysical themes. And I mean, to answer your question more directly, I think what's so fascinating to me about the movie, and Asias has actually spoken to this out on the circuit, the interview circuit, is that, I mean, when was the last time there was a movie in which the ghosts were neither entirely necessarily real nor entirely metaphorical, mm-hmm. where that inhabit this middle space where, yes, it may or may not be a figment of someone's imagination, but also, how is that any less or more real than any other ghost presented in fiction or any other ghost that we confront in real life? So, I mean, if you don't mind me reading what he says, I mean, he really gets to, he said at the Cannes press conference, what I tried to do in this film was to connect the reality we live in with our imagination. I think we live on both sides of that mirror. We do a job and we have our imagination, and also we have the people we lost. We have our memories, and it's a very inhabited solitude. So it's so easy to think of we have dreams, and we dream of people that are here and that are gone. And we think of dreams as this sort of non-real, ethereal thing that's kind of a trick of the mind. But what's so great about this movie is that it posits that all of these things that we connect to imaginatively and memorially, I mean, these are legitimate ghosts. Mm-hmm. And I just found it so moving, and it just, the movie itself takes a really kind of weird imaginative detour into these old spiritualists from years and years ago and how they perceived art. So the whole thing is like, you know, it's not just about grief. It's not just about this brother that's lost. The movie itself is about how we imaginatively summon these spirits.
Yeah.
And I just think it's so special. I mean, and it's such a strange, puzzling movie that I hope that people who maybe have slightly more genre-based or mainstream tastes will kind of take a step towards it and meet it where it's at.
Yeah.
And engage with it.
Yeah. Well, you certainly touched on one of the things I really loved about the movie in terms of the directness of the ghost story. I think that it wouldn't have been a surprise at all if Asayas had instead played it very coy and left a ton of ambiguity. Not that there isn't ambiguity here, there definitely is, but sort of that, well, we'll let you, the viewer, decide what's real and what isn't. And I think he does, to an extent, put that question on us, but he also makes some things quite literal. And I thought that that was refreshing. And in your piece, you actually touch on some of the different ways that ghosts come up here. It's not just in terms of the presence that she does encounter and is maybe also seeking out, but there are all sorts of other specters running around this film, aren't there?
Yes, there's the digital, the coded boyfriend that we never see in the flesh. We only see him on the screen. Incidentally, that actor, by the way, is Chicago-based.
Really?
And yeah, so it was weird to see him up there.
Yeah, and they only talk over Skype. He's in another country.
They talk over Skype, and then, but even the, without giving anything away, even whatever presence is behind these text messages is manifesting itself in digital textural form, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so there's all these beings communicating with each other, but they may or may not be worldly. They may or may not be otherworldly, but the boyfriend keeps freezing up. You know, the boyfriend keeps the Skype is this like jerky, non-real thing. He might as well be a ghost.
Right.
You know, and that's scary to a certain extent. It's also kind of exciting that we live amongst all of these ghosts. And I don't know, there's something kind of exciting about it in a weird way.
Well, we're using Personal Shopper as sort of our entry point to consider Kristen Stewart's career thus far and the recent critical respect that she's garnered. So I'm also curious to hear what you made of her performance here. I know in your piece you described it as one of the most vulnerable screen performances I've ever seen. So can you talk a little bit about, you know, what you thought of it in general and how it also interacted with some of these elements that we've already been talking about in Personal Shopper?
Yeah, the movie, again, it felt intensely private. And I felt like not only via, I'll say it's this script, but I felt like Kristen Stewart in all of her eccentricities and oddness and nerviness was trusting a story and trusting a filmmaker so wholly that she just devoted her most innermost secrets and fears to this role. And I mean, I don't think any of her sort of Kristen Stewartisms could have been further from mannered, or I mean, they felt to me wholly authentic. I mean, the whole movie felt like just being in a room with Kristen Stewart musing on metaphysics and loss and the fear of extinction. And I just think it's a perfect synthesis of performer and material and role. So she's all, I mean, that's always been her thing. She's always just deeply, she is what you get, you know? And one of the interesting things about her, I think, is that she's so authentic that you can tell when she's not happy in a role. So she's best when she's thrilled to be there and thrilled with the material. And my favorite performances of hers are like Adventureland and The Runaways, even Panic Room. I mean, she's so young there, but she's also like, has she ever been more excited to be in a movie than in that movie? I mean, imagine that experience. But yeah, I mean, and Into the Wild, I mean, I think she gives a really special performance.
Mm-hmm.
It's not that it would be condescending to say that she needs a director or she needs a good script. That's not necessarily true. She can stand on her own in whatever schlock she's in. But I also think that one of her strengths is that she's so kind of such a raw nerve that you can see when something's not quite right with her relationship with the material.
Well, I think that's going to help us transition perfectly here into our takes on Stewart and our favorite scenes and moments from her work. But we do want to say thank you, Stephen, for your insights here. And even though you're just on the other end of the phone, we're going to presume that you're not actually a ghost. We've seen you before.
Well, you never know, you know?
Your latest film, we mentioned, Henry Gamble's Birthday Party, is available to stream on Netflix and recommended by both of us and many other critics. We will link to more on Stephen Cohn and his work in the notes for the show at filmspotting.net. Thank you so much for your time, Stephen.
Good to talk to you.
Thanks, guys. Good to talk to you.
After death, there's nothing.
He's here.
Personal Shopper out in limited release right now and opened here in Chicago this past weekend. We didn't get a whole lot of time there, Josh, to share our thoughts on the movie, and we do want to get to Stewart, but I can say not only do I recommend the film right now, granted, I've only seen six or seven movies from 2017, but it's my favorite of the year so far.
Your favorite?
Yeah.
Okay. Don't have it quite that high, but I did enjoy it quite a bit.
We want to know what you think. If you've had a chance to see it, feedback at filmspotting.net. As always, our email address.
I'm Joan Jett. I play guitar, electric guitar.
Oh, Joan Jett, that's a cool name. You guys got a demo?
No, I don't. No guys. I want to start an all-girl rock band.
Well, Stephen Cohn mentioned The Runaways and Kristen Stewart's performance as Joan Jett in that film, the movie about the all-female rock group that kind of took L.A. by storm in the mid to late 70s. There in that scene with Michael Shannon as Kim Fowley, who's a music producer and who's their manager, and he is delightfully fun in that film, was my favorite thing about that film back in 2010. And I was sure, Josh, maybe it's because of the critical reconsideration of Stewart, I just assumed that I was a huge fan of Stewart's performance in that movie. And I went back and looked at my notes and kind of mixed on the film, kind of mixed on her. Rewatching a lot of scenes from it for this show, I've changed my thoughts on her. And I think it's because the way we've seen her evolve through the work of directors like Olivier Assayas. Maybe it was a matter of not her needing to catch up to anything I'm doing, but me needing to catch up to what she's doing. And I think we'll talk about what we see her doing on screen as we get to our top five Kristen Stewart scenes. And it's funny, when I went back and looked at those notes, Josh, I had the setup for that show. Maddie was sitting opposite me, and that was the same episode where we shared our top five actresses of the decade. It was 2010, after all. And my setup question for Maddie was, 10 years from now, what are the chances that one or both of the young actresses at the center of The Runaways, Kristen Stewart and Dakota Fanning, what are the chances that one of them will make our list 10 years from now, looking back on the decade? And the fact is, it really was, like a lot of our setups are, just a provocation to get the conversation going. At the time in 2010, I had no thoughts at all that Kristen Stewart might genuinely be in that conversation. But right now, as we sit in 2017, how could you try to form that list and at least not consider her? You'd have to, right?
That's what we've been doing. I mean, I haven't given her that sort of consideration, really. I've only seen, you know, not even half of her films. I think we've both managed to now see the ones that most people regard as the important ones. But it is this reappraisal that's been happening the last few years that's forced me, too, to think, okay, I got to look more closely. I got, you know, at some of the specific scenes, visit films I haven't seen before. And for me, it was more just trying to get, not really a quality thing, and where does she rank? It was just trying to get a grasp on what does she do on screen. And so that was what I was excited about having the opportunity to do.
Well, we'll wrestle with that here in a moment. But if you are out there thinking, I've seen a handful or several Kristen Stewart films, I don't know what all the fuss is about, and that's totally fair, you're not alone in terms of the people producing this show. We can mention that one of the people behind the scenes was not necessarily all that on board with our desire to do this top five, and actually suggested, looking back, we've done these types of appraisals of actors' careers for people like Robert De Niro and Philip Seymour Hoffman. Why her? So part of the question is, where's the body of work? And then you could also ask, where's the talent? And some of the names that were mentioned, Scarlett Johansson, Jennifer Lawrence, even Mia Wasikowska, Saoirse Ronan, Brie Larson, all, some might argue, or some of them, better actresses maybe than Kristen Stewart. But I think what we talked about, Josh, is that none of those actresses, I think it's fair to say, have captured the imagination of critics anyway, and some moviegoers the way Stewart has recently. And there are some very formidable voices in film criticism who are all in on Stewart beyond Stephen Cohn, including Wesley Morris and A.O. Scott, who in the New York Times, when they did their piece, A Dialogue Between Them, about the great performances of the year 2016, A.O. Scott said his hunch is that Kristen Stewart is the new Robert De Niro. He says, she doesn't, of course, transform physically the way De Niro has made a career out of doing, or at least did early in his career. But according to Scott, she burrows as deeply as De Niro ever has into the interiors of her characters. And he says, the fact that she's the most interesting person in all the films she was in 2016, including Cafe Society, Certain Women, and Billy Lynn's Long Halftime Walk, suggests that her movie star charisma is still intact. She's just using it in subtle and occasionally subversive ways. And Wesley Morris adds, I think Kristen Stewart is just about the best American movie actress we have. So,
okay,
yes, so some hyperbole there.
Time to temper all of that a little bit.
We'll see.
This is what I found. She's very, to my mind, she's extreme. She excels at doing some things very well. And as a result of that, there are some things that are not in her, they're not her strong suit. And you can see when certain movies place her in the positions to not be able to excel, at least from the small sample size that I've taken and getting ready for the show, gives me that impression. And let me give you an idea of what I'm talking about. I think Personal Shopper is a good place to start because she's one of those ghosts that Cohn is talking about, not literally, but
yes. She
has that sense in the movie. She's an apparition. She's elusive. She's ephemeral. You can't pin her down. And I think some people have claimed that that makes her a bad actress because you can't say this is exactly what she's doing easily, okay? And
right.
So they will read that as blank.
Mm-hmm.
And that's been a criticism of hers. Now you have others who go way the other way, the people that you've mentioned. And I think, you know, my experience of her work at this point is that she's something in between those two positions. She's a master of reticence, just an absolute master of that. But perhaps because of that, I think she can be a little bit limited when it comes to conveying a genuine connection between two people.
Really?
That's where I see some of the scenes, and there are exceptions. We'll get to Clouds of Sils Maria.
There's a bunch of exceptions
Clouds
we're about
to get to. Clouds of Sils Maria is one where, you know, she's on – it's a relationship movie, and I think it's her best performance of that I've seen. But think about, you know, the first time I saw her on screen, Stephen mentioned it, in David Fincher's Panic Room. She played a character there who was literally withdrawn, right? She's this diabetic tween who's hiding in the safe room with her mother. And the posture she has there that she has to adopt, it's curled up, it's leaning back, it's turning away. And that is still, I think, her defining quality or her go-to position as an actress on screen. And I think you can say that even in something like, you know, the swoony Twilight series, which Stephen pointed out that maybe when she's not as invested in the material, then it's not going to work. I think there's probably some of that going on there. But she's also too withdrawn to pull off this heavy breathing Bella character that she was supposed to be playing. You never believed that central relationship between the two of them. You always felt that Bella wasn't after Edward, right? You'll be able to back me up on this.
It was Edward,
right?
Oh, yeah. Okay. I'm the expert.
She wasn't after Edward as much as she wanted his doomed, lonely lifestyle more than she wanted him. That's the feeling I always got, okay?
Yeah.
So I think what makes her fascinating is that it's the same thing that makes her frustrating. She's this movie star that we can't have in the way that we like to have movie stars because her true talent is keeping us at a distance. That's not like a good or bad thing. I think that is what makes her an alluring presence.
I would say it's definitely more good than bad because there is that allure. There is something that you can't help but be drawn to. There's a mystery you're constantly trying to solve.
But there are scenes where that doesn't work. And, you know, Twilight is maybe the easy example to give of that. But I think even in a good film like Personal Shopper, there are scenes that suddenly require her to be connecting with another person personally and in a vulnerable way. And there's just the disconnect there for me, where in Personal Shopper, and we'll get to it on our list, so I don't want to spoil it. When she's alone, the word Stephen was using, solitude, intensely private, those are the ones that sing.
Hmm. Yeah, I kind of know where you're going, and I don't completely disagree. At the same time, I think that I still feel like when she is interacting with people in this film, it's meant to have that sort of awkwardness of people trying to connect in a world where they're much more used to connecting with people constantly over text. And I wanted to mention to Stephen that that's a huge part of this film, where we have this other ghostly presence in Personal Shopper that is sending her these harassing text messages. And look, we all do that every day. Another presence is the presence we project of ourselves when we're interacting with people over text messages. And you add to it the layer of she doesn't know who she's talking to. And when she then is forced to actually try to connect with another individual, it's still fraught with that kind of artificiality. And I think it works. I think it definitely works.
Well,
we're going to
get trapped into a Personal Shopper conversation, but I'm thinking of the one with her client's lover.
Yeah.
A long extended exposition scene where all of the sudden she just starts spilling her gut. It's not that the reticence is a problem there. It's that all of a sudden it's completely gone. And it's not true to that character in particular that she opens up so much to this guy she just met. And it's also not true to Stewart's talent as a performer.
What are you doing in Paris?
I'm waiting. I'm gonna go.
What are you waiting for?
My brother died here. My twin brother died in Paris.
An accident?
No. No, heart attack. I actually have the same malformation.
I will give you briefly that when he started to engage her in a conversation and she stopped walking out the door and turned around and engaged with him, I thought that felt false. But then it also made sense to me that that character in that moment, who was so used to not having any kind of actual conversation with people, would say, okay, I'm going to put my guard down for a second. I'm going to actually do this. I thought it made sense. But let's talk about connection. It's going to be a big part of this. I think physicality is going to be a big part of what we single out when we single out the scenes and the moments that we love from very good to great Kristen Stewart performances. And I want to go back for number 5 here. We're doing a joint list. to Into the Wild from 2007, another one that Steven mentioned. And it's Chris and Tracy's goodbye. Chris, played by Emil Hirsch. He's Christopher McCandless, the kid who is heading off to Alaska. And this is kind of his last big stop, his last big encounter with society before he goes off for his life of solitude in Alaska. And he meets this teenage girl, Tracy, who Stewart manages to convey without doing a whole lot that she has enough hormones flowing through her that it prompts Chris's friend Rainey to say that poor girl is about ready to vault herself onto a fence post. And yes, there is that element to her performance and her character, but like her playing Joan Jett in The Runaways, this is another bit that involves her playing a guitar and performing. Josh, a lot of people listening might think I'm going to go with the Angel from Montgomery duet scene where they're playing this great John Prine song and she sings and Hirsch joins her in the duet singing for these people who have all joined together at a place they call Slab City, which is just a snowbird kind of camping ground. But for me, it's the moment right after. The song and that performance, Angel from Montgomery, dissolves into their goodbye. They've made this connection. She's only 16 years old, though, so he hasn't engaged with her sexually, but they've certainly had some kind of bond over this brief time they've been together. And Sean Penn, the director, really stages this goodbye wonderfully, where it starts with the camera panning slowly across the campground. We see the camper that he's going to be going away in, pulling in, and then it cuts to Chris and Tracy, and Chris is in profile, and the close-up is really on Stewart's face as he's telling her where she can send him mail.
You can send mail to this address. It's South Dakota. I don't know when I'm gonna get it, but I'll get it. Hey, you're pretty magic.
Yeah?
Yeah.
She's clearly upset. She's sad that he's going, but there's something more than that in her face. It's not just anger or sadness. It's almost like, the only way I can describe it, like she's trying to will him to stay with her eyes. She's not doing anything physically in this moment, but there's nothing passive about the scene whatsoever. And it extends to the moment where they finally do say goodbye, and he shares this cheesy platitude with her. He says, if you want something in life, reach out and grab it. And that's where this physicality comes in, where she then gives him a hug. And it's something I think we see in a lot of Stewart performances. She makes a slightly unconventional choice. In The Runaways, it's the way she smokes a cigarette. It's the way she hunches her shoulders like she's always ready for a fight. Here, she doesn't just throw her arms around him. It's not a hug like we've given or been given a million times, but she actually cups the back of his neck and pulls her toward him in that moment. And I love that choice, and I love the aggressiveness of it. Again, nothing passive there, but also it is her literally reaching out and grabbing him. Just as he expressed to her, whatever you want, just go and get it. Well, she does. She does in that moment, and yet he obviously doesn't stay. So there's a bittersweet irony to this whole endeavor, and we know it's going to play out in terms of ultimately how things end for Chris. And I think that's where this scene also really hits me in terms of some emotional resonance, because we know that he could have this, whether it's her or someone else, that type of connection, that bond with another person. He's about to let it all slip away in this quest to find himself and his determination to be alone.
Yeah, Into the Wild, my favorite film of 2007, and Stewart, one of the reasons for that. I'm going to jump ahead about 10 years exactly and go to Kelly Reichardt's Certain Women. And this is the horseback riding scene that many people who have seen this film come out of it talking about. Stewart anchors one of the triptychs here in Reichardt's movie. She plays a young lawyer who travels to middle of nowhere, Montana, once a week to teach a class on school law. A ranch hand, played by Lily Gladstone, crashes the class and becomes infatuated with her. So they form this tentative relationship. She sits in on the class. They go out afterwards for a late night dinner. I think this is probably Certain Women's best scene, when Gladstone offers to give her a ride on her horse after class and she accepts. There's a quiet understanding between them there that no words are used at all to express what they both come to realize and know. And I like towards the end of this where Stewart just leans in slightly.
Mm-hmm.
And in a movie that's very matter of fact in its framing and its camera work also allows them to pass in front of a streetlight at one point so that a halo glows over them. And that's a big flourish for someone like Reichert in a movie like this. And I think it's also fitting that here, going back to this idea of reticence as Stewart's real talent, that her character here can't express this until she's not facing the Gladstone character. Mm-hmm. So that just makes a lot of sense for the character in the film and for Stewart as well.
Yeah, without a doubt. And again, it's something physical. It's a gesture and it's an actual connection in a film where the heartbreak of the movie is in watching two people so thoroughly disconnect from each other. Even as most of the film, we see them just sitting across from each other at a diner, and it is almost as if they are two completely different people having two completely different conversations at the exact same time. I did want to highlight a comment about that performance and those scenes from Nick Davis, because he's an instructor here at Northwestern. He's a film critic, and he wrote an article that's in the July/August issue of Film Comment, so going back last summer, called Hiding in Plain Sight, that considers Stewart's career. And I think he really expresses this well. He says, throughout, in fact, we never know when Beth's friendly but terse responses to Jamie, Beth is Stewart's character, imply exhaustion, class-based discomfort, embarrassed detection of erotic feeling, or just a personal habitus. Stewart and Gladstone convey bottled-up characters without making an incongruously big show of playing, your word, Josh, reticence, or over-explicating their secrets and pauses. Their exertions turn an anecdote of two people not connecting into a rare display of two actresses doing just that. There is something remarkable going on in that scene, just as Nick said, where I can imagine how two lesser performers would make a show of playing disconnection.
Yeah, because they'd be afraid otherwise there will be nothing there.
Yeah, and instead it's absolutely organic to what is transferring in the space between them. And that's what makes it remarkable, as opposed to certain mannerisms or certain ways of speaking. You mentioned a lean in, and a lean in is a big part of a scene that I chose for our number three, and it's from the 2014 film Still Alice, which won Julianne Moore, if I remember correctly, a Best Actress Oscar. She plays Kristen Stewart's mom. She's a linguist who has an early onset of Alzheimer's, and she has a complex relationship with her daughter, Lydia, who's played by Stewart. And somebody on Twitter, when we threw out this topic, Josh, mentioned the scene that actually I first thought of, and what I think is the most devastating scene in the movie, the most devastating moment, is when Lydia, who has been fighting with her mom about her desire to continue to be an actress, that's what she wants to pursue while her siblings are more stable. One is a med student. I think one's a law student. She has a play. She has a performance, and Julianne Moore comes backstage, her mother, and compliments her on the performance, but it becomes clear at some point that she actually doesn't know who she is. She doesn't know it's her daughter anyway. She thinks it's just an actress who she watched a few moments ago. That's devastating, but I couldn't find that online, and I actually think the end scene is just as good. She's now taking care of her mom, and Moore's condition has pretty well deteriorated, and she's reading, Lydia is reading a scene from Tony Kushner's Angels in America, and she does really Moore perform it. And I don't remember the exact context. It's been a while since I saw the film, whether she is doing the part or has done the part before, but she kind of starts channeling the text, this amazing monologue that Kushner wrote. And she goes from channeling it to living in it and really living in the text and the images that it evokes. And when she's done with the reading, she goes and sits down by her mother and she says, "Did you like it?" And she's sitting next to her, facing her. She's trying to connect with her through this art, but she's still looking for her mom's approval, and she leans in when she says it. She's not just sitting back, though close to her mother, asking what she thought of it. She's trying urgently to get out of her something that she still needs from her mother. And it's not only that approval, but I think what we've seen throughout the film, again, she was a linguist, this professor. She's always been the person who's had the answer, the person who's always been able to hear words and decipher meaning. And she needs this from her mother in this moment. She needs that connection and she needs that guidance. And as I said, it's so subtle, but just this little lean into her mother gives the whole scene this great sense of urgency. And I think it's just great acting. It's not about what her character is doing, but what's fundamental to performing. It's about what her character's objective is and without overplaying it, we know precisely what Lydia needs from her mother in that moment.
Did you like that? What I just read. Did you like it? What was it about?
Love. Yeah, love.
Yeah, Mom. It was about love.
Yeah, there's a somewhat similar scene we'll get to where she's working with other text and performing while performing that I think shows the multiple layers Stewart can manage at once.
Mm-hmm.
The number two film we picked, though, is Personal Shopper. And there were two scenes I thought about here that both have to do with what I was mentioning about Stewart being best in my mind as a solitary performer, that she's best when she's alone on the screen. And the opening of Personal Shopper is an extended sequence like that where she goes to this mansion, really kind of a worn down mansion where her brother had been living, and she's trying to commune with what she suspects might be his spirit, wandering through this amazing place, all these doors that she keeps passing through, and they all have glass windows. So there's multiple dimensions at play just visually here. But she's often in darkness as well, and there's a furtiveness to it. And somehow the way she holds the screen by communicating that we're watching someone who doesn't want to be seen. Okay, so it's that playing with that tension is really great. But I went with another scene from Personal Shopper, and this has a brazenness to it. She's alone. It's when she defies her client's orders, and she's in her client's apartment. Client is away on a trip, and she goes ahead and tries on these high fashion dresses that she usually shops for but otherwise isn't really allowed to touch. You know, given that Maureen, the Stewart character, normally wears this nondescript sweater, this is quite a transformation scene, and it's one that's communicated, yeah, through the change of clothing, obviously, but as you've been pointing out, through the physicality.
Mm-hmm.
And just look at the way Stewart carries herself and how it changes within that scene, how her shoulders, again, lose that hunched expression, and her gaze even. When she looks into the mirror, it becomes more direct than it ever is anywhere else in the movie. But again, she's alone when she's doing this.
And there's a softness to it that we don't otherwise see in her character in that moment. I think when she sees herself reflected,
that really comes through. And even an elegance in the way she does begin to move. So this is, you know, I think it's Maureen's declaration of independence, though notably it's a statement she can only make when she's alone.
Yeah, that independence is so key, as we're going to get to our number one choice here. And I think we can spoil it that we're sticking with Aseas in terms of our favorite scenes. We're drawing from his work and Stewart's work, and it isn't lost on me that in both films, she's playing assistants, basically. She's there to serve other great women in their pursuits. And yet something about Stewart and her individuality is constantly bursting through. The conflict seems to be her desire and her ability to be a good servant, so to speak. But at the same time, she's constantly recognizing that cost. And that really comes through. And I think for me, in terms of thinking about Personal Shopper especially, what I've decided that works for me about Stewart, the best way I can describe it is her characters are all self-aware, but Stewart isn't at all self-conscious. So the characters often exhibit a heightened awareness of their contradictions, their flaws, their strengths, their power, their sexuality, whatever it is. And somehow Stewart is just incapable of suppressing that. Actors talk all the time about wanting to feel comfortable on a set. They have to trust a director. Stewart, to me, always acts as if she must be shooting at every point in the safest space for her imaginable because, to go back to Stephen's words, she's completely vulnerable. I think in every moment, there's no shame, there's no fear, there's no embarrassment. And I'm sure that those are factors for her, like anyone else. She's just able to somehow harness it when she hears action. And I'll go back to another performance of hers that I remember made its way around social media back in December. It's her performance in the Rolling Stones video for the blues cover Write 'Em Down. Did you see this?
Mm-mm.
So she's the key figure, really the only figure in this Rolling Stones video. And we see her driving this amazing vehicle. I want to say it's a Mustang, a blue Mustang. licking a blue lollipop. She's dancing while she's driving in the car, licking the lollipop in a very exaggerated way. She later dances at a gas pump in a pseudo stripper fashion. And it's not that it's bad dancing, but it's not good dancing either. It's not that it's sexy, but it's not unsexy. And there is a certain awkwardness to it, I think anyone would have to admit, but it's just this raw expression of exuberance and of energy. I think anybody watching it could be just as easily turned on by it as they could be moved to mock it, but Stewart just doesn't care. And maybe that is the vulnerability ultimately that we're talking about. It's at least what I think I'm responding to in her work. And that brings us to our joint choice here for the best Kristen Stewart scene, and it is from Clouds of Sils Maria, which you just caught up with. It was one of my favorite films, just missed my top 10 of the previous year.
I know, and I've been doing a bad job of correcting that mistake, so this was another good excuse to do that. I'm so glad I did. I really liked it, more than Personal Shopper, as a matter of fact. And this is sort of the consensus pick, I think, for Stewart's performances. We're not breaking any new ground here. She won the French equivalent of the Oscar for this. And what a wonderful film about just such a unique relationship, although it is an assistant role. Again, this time she's the assistant to a French actress named Maria, played by Juliette Binoche. Val is the character name for Stewart here. And the plot centers on this revival of a play that launched Maria to stardom some 20 years earlier. Back then, she played the part of this youthful temptress who seduces an older woman. Now, she's been cast in the older role. So as part of this preparation, and here's the scene that I wanted to mention, Maria and Val read scenes from the original play, of course, Maria now in the different role. And I think it might be the first time they do this. It's a really extended line reading scene. And Val is now reading the part of the younger woman. Maria is attempting to perform the older part. And I think it's the best work Stewart has done because it incorporates everything that we've been talking about, and even that I've been talking about is sometimes what I see as weaknesses. Here it becomes an absolute strength. Now, up until this point, she's given this, for me, a really surprisingly warm, open-hearted connection performance. She and Binoche, I mean, they could almost be sisters extended by a couple extra years.
Yeah.
They're just so in sync together. So this was something, for me at least, that was pretty new. She's so open to her co-star here, not turned away from her, not trying to cut her off, nothing like that. So that was really fun to see. But when they're reading the play's dialogue, then she slips back into what we normally think of as a Kristen Stewart performance, or at least what I think of, you know, aloof and aggressive. This is the younger woman part.
They're using you to humiliate me. It's not just your youth or your powers of seduction.
No, it's your aplomb,
your unshakable self-confidence.
You don't know me.
Nothing gets through you. You radiate self-confidence.
And you don't.
I wear a mask. It works with some people. Others see right through it. I can tell which is which right away. There's one thing I excel at. That's reading people's behavior.
So how should I be reading yours?
How do you think?
I don't know, I'm reluctant to say it, but it's pretty clear.
Don't be reluctant.
Helena nervously crosses and uncrosses her legs, reaches for a cigarette.
I don't know if this is something actors do, but she'll stop to say the stage directions. And she'll just drop the performance, but she's not really becoming Val again. She's kind of becoming this, like, it's a reality breaker. And then she becomes Val. And then goes back and forth. And it's such, to watch her moving back and forth like that is just really a wonder. And there's one line she gives as the play character now. She says to Maria, "You don't know me." And it fits for the play, but also based on what we've seen and what's happening to their relationship, Maria's beginning to wonder, maybe she doesn't know Val. And we can sense that Val sending messages, or maybe even exploring the possibility of sending messages at this point. There's just so much going on in this scene, and it's really something.
Yeah, it is. And I just rewatched it today in preparation for this discussion. And there's a flatness that some might decide is a negative to the line where she says, "You don't know me," but I love it for all the reasons you said, but because what it really gets at is, think about all the ways that character there, playing a character, could say, you don't know me, and actually betray things about themselves to the other person.
Yeah.
You could say, you don't know me, so many different ways that would suggest a self-confidence or a certain desire to seduce, or just you're trying to play mystery. You're trying to play mysterious. That could all be expressed and more. But in that moment, Stewart plays that character who just means exactly what she says. You don't know me.
Yeah.
It's as simple as that. And that whole conversation, you nailed it, works on the level of the parts the characters are playing running lines. It works on the level of the parts the characters are playing with each other. And there's that third, perhaps, layer of Binoche and Stewart, the actresses playing with each other.
And their personas.
Yeah.
Definitely Stewart's persona. I mean, this is, you know, this is a movie that's meta in so many ways. There's some jabs at Hollywood, and there's references to werewolves at one point.
Yep.
So it definitely is aware of the perception of Stewart. Never lets that become the main thing.
No.
Or derail what is mostly going on in the film, but it is just one more element there at play.
Yeah, another great candidate from Clouds of Sils Maria is the scene after they go see that space movie starring Chloe Grace Moretz's character in this film, and she has to try to argue with Juliette Binoche about how there's nothing invalid or, I suppose, non-profound about this film just because it takes place in space. That's another great one.
Remind me of some of our conversations.
Yeah. Wonder what role I'm playing in your version of that scene, Josh.
Let's just leave it at that.
We will link to much more about Stewart in our show notes, including the Nick Davis article, which you can read some of online from Film Comment, and we'll post this entire list over at filmspotting.net under Top Fives.
Film Spotting Madness time when we come back. Did millennials come out in force to vote against Citizen Kane? Did Back to the Future finally run out of plutonium? Stay with us.
Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes is coming to IMAX and theaters everywhere.
What a wonderful day!
This summer, one movie event will reign.
It is our time.
They stole my village.
I know where they're taking your clan.
Bend for your king.
Never.
Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. Only in theaters May 10. Tickets on sale now. Rated PG-13. Some material may be inappropriate for children under 13.
I love you so much. And I hate this war so much. Oh, it's a crazy world. Anything can happen. If you shouldn't get away. I mean, if something should keep us apart, wherever they put you and wherever I'll be, I want you to know that. Kiss me. Kiss me as if it were the last time.
Ingrid Bergman in Casablanca, sounding very much like some of our listeners as they take part in the crazy world of Film Spotting Madness.
I love you so much, Back to the Future. I hate this war so much.
There you go. Last week, Casablanca made it past Scorsese's Taxi Driver, much to my chagrin, to make it to the Sweet 16. Will it be among the Elite Eight? Our Madness results coming up here in just a second. There is, however, another reason we played that clip from Casablanca next week in honor of the film's 75th anniversary. 75-year-old Michael Phillips and I.
Oh,
just
come
a dig,
on.
Just a dig at Michael. We'll have a sacred cow review of the Michael Curtiz-directed classic.
I think you're going to find yourself without a host next week.
Maybe. Are you jealous that you're going to miss out on this or not?
I love this film. This is, you know, it's obviously one of the most rewatchable ones, so always to have an excuse to look at it again is great. It's in the pantheon already, so maybe not a ton of surprise of where Well, unless Michael ends up not liking it.
Maybe he hates it. We don't know.
That's a possibility,
maybe he thinks
I guess.
It's as bad as Raiders of the Lost Ark, and he's going to petition to kick it out of the Pantheon. This is the first Sacred Cow discussion without one of us hosts, though, I believe.
Really?
We've had Michael in as a third wheel, but...
You had your vocal issue during 2001.
That's true.
You were here in body and spirit, but not voice.
I was running the board, but I think I did have some psychosomatic reaction to... trying to wrestle with Stanley Kubrick's masterpiece. We'll see how that did.
Is that why you keep voting,
Madness.
Keep voting for it in the tournament to make up for that?
I lost my voice. Maybe the only time in the show's history, the day we were supposed to discuss that film. Okay, well, you and Michael did a wonderful job. Film Spotting Madness, let's get to it. 64 films, only one can reign supreme. As we've been highlighting over the past few weeks, we've taken all the films that are already in our pantheon, favorite films of ours that have been cast aside, and Sacred Cow. Some of them in the Pantheon, some of them not in the Pantheon that we are considering for that status, but movies we saw 10 years ago, 20 years ago, or more, and we're revisiting and trying to see if they still hold up. We took all those movies, put them together, and we've had our own March Madness-style tourney knocking films out forever as we go. They are extinct if you vote against them.
As are all films outside of the tournament.
Exactly.
Okay.
So whatever one film is left, this is a really bleak world.
There's only one movie.
We do want to make another quick note about the timing. The new polls will always open late Thursday nights at midnight. So Wednesday/Thursday at midnight, and then the polls will close Mondays at 5 p.m. Central Time. So you only have about a four-day window to get your votes in. We encourage you to vote early, and you can try to vote often. It's the Chicago way, after all. Thousands of votes again this week, and we will highlight them in the order of biggest blowouts to the narrowest margin of victory. But as I said, we had fewer blowouts, we had fewer big blowouts, and we didn't have really the down-to-the-wire four-vote style battles like we did with The Shining and Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind last week either.
Most importantly, when am I going to find out how I'm doing in our...
Oh, I've got some news for you.
Really? I took a hit?
Oh, it's
crap.
Not good, Josh.
What?
It's not good.
I thought
for...
I was okay.
No, it's not good for either of us. I've got an update on that coming here in a little bit. Matchup number one, The Godfather. Always mentioning the higher seed in the tournament first, The Godfather versus Alien. The Godfather took down Young Frankenstein in round one, and before Sunrise in round two, Alien took down Terrence Malick's The Tree of Life and Billy Wilder's The
Those
apartment.
Are some impressive wins. Yep. We heard from Billy Ray Bruton. The speed at which you both voted for The Godfather hurts my heart, but I suppose most folks are automatically programmed to say, how high, whenever The Godfather says jump.
Maybe.
Alien is an absolute masterpiece of genre, tone, and directorial precision, and it's the only horror film left in Film Spotting Madness. I might be the only one who votes, but that is fine by me.
Mike H. writes in, over the last few weeks, Adam and Josh have quoted multiple versions of the sentiment that Citizen Kane is the favorite film of those who either don't watch a lot of movies, want to sound smart, or haven't seen Citizen Kane. I think it's safe to say the same is generally true for the Godfather films, especially the original. But the last time I rewatched this movie, about 6 months ago, it really settled in for me that this is one of those rare category of films that is simultaneously overrated and underrated. Which is to say, you can agree that a film is fairly regarded as one of the best ever, and still not really personally appreciate just how effing amazing it truly is. I think at any given time, the vast majority of film fans are in some stage of underappreciating The Godfather. If Alien wins out, it can only prove my point. And that's not to say Alien isn't a work of genius in its own right, only that The Godfather deserves to win, but probably won't, simply because nobody wants to see another list with Godfather at the top.
Well, Mike,
what's going to happen, Josh?
There's a chance Godfather might be at the top. It did win 65% of the vote. Alien, 35%.
Not bad, but 2/3 of listeners going with The Godfather. Our second matchup, there it is, 2001, A Space Odyssey. I think every time we say 2001, A Space Odyssey, Sam needs to bring up the music. Against your beloved Back to the Future. 2001 on its way here, took down To Kill a Mockingbird and Do the Right Thing. Back to the Future beat Groundhog Day and, oh, I don't know, just Raging Bull.
Raging Bull, how about that for the Cinderella team in this tournament?
Yeah, Javier Gonzalez in New Orleans said, I was about to vote for 2001 when I started thinking, do I really want to watch 30 minutes of apes skull bashing and that interdimensional 20-minute acid trip? Or would I rather listen to some Johnny B. Goode and hang out with Doc? If it is about preserving a piece of artwork for future generations, I would keep 2001. But for this one, I'm going with what I would rather watch whenever I feel like it. And I'm always up for Back to the Future. Plus, DeLorean is greater than Hal.
Can't argue with that, Javier.
Can the DeLorean sing Daisy?
Probably.
Case closed.
I don't think we ever got to that point. Ben Hemphill in Reading, Pennsylvania. Every other movie left in Film Spotting Madness feels a bit academic, like the syllabus for my intro to film class from freshman year of college. Back to the Future is not only the best movie of the 1980s. Whoa, more than 85. That was our debate, right?
He's doubling down on the Josh Larson insanity.
Going for the whole decade. All right, I like it, Ben. It is pure cinematic joy, he says. I'm jumping on the Cinderella bandwagon and cheering for Back to the Future to go all the way.
Christopher Redman from DearCastAndCrew.com. Thank God the world had 2001 A Space Odyssey, so it could inspire so many important filmmakers for decades to come, all of whom, unfortunately, will have to eat the fire dust of a DeLorean. Sorry, Stanley.
All right, David Hoffman in Queens. I've got to do this in a HAL voice.
Huh? Go for it.
I'm sorry, Marty, but I just can't let you continue to the next round.
Well done. And that is indeed how it played out, because HAL was not going to be denied. The survival instinct is too strong for man or machine. Josh, 61% to Back to the Future's 39%. And I'll be honest, behind the scenes, me and Sam, we're wondering who these 39% of crazy people are. That's the power of love.
That's the power of love. This is no fun anymore.
You're just done like that.
What's the point?
Okay.
Fine.
Let's move on.
Godfather Part 2 versus Star Wars. So Godfather Part 2 beat In America in round one. Not much of a challenge there. The Big Lebowski in round two. Star Wars faced The Breakfast Club, oddly enough, in round one, and then took down One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest in round two. Here's David Hoffman in Queens again. So I watched Star Wars for the first time in a long time a few months ago with my wife, who, believe it or not, had never seen it. I was so excited to show it to her and hunted up a bootleg copy of the original theatrical release, Han Shoots First, yada yada, for the occasion. And you know what? I hate to say this now, as much as I hated to realize it then, but it's just not that good. It really isn't.
You're wrong.
There are some amazing images, and it's the kind of swashbuckler that makes the hearts of young boys everywhere swoon, but the dialogue is terrible, the direction ham-fisted, and the whole thing is about as shallow as a kiddie pool. It will always have a place in my heart for how much I loved it when I was 10, but better than Godfather 2, not a chance. Let the hate mail commence. This is just getting less fun.
That's David Hoffman in Queens. We'll try to dig up his email address and you can address him directly. I disagree with literally everything he wrote there, except for the part where it gets picked ahead of The Godfather Part 2. I voted for The Godfather Part 2. No, the dialogue is fine.
It's a good script. Pretty bad.
Nope, it's a good script. Sorry, not buying it. Luke Paymer in Indianapolis says, have we stopped to consider what kind of world Film Spotting Madness is taking place in? A monstrosity of a world where only one film eventually survives? And if that is the case, how could you not need Star Wars to hold on to when everything else has been lost? And it is true that over the weekend, Sam asked me, do we need to let listeners know that just because we're getting rid of all these films, that there's still things to do, like talk with your family, go for a picnic.
Film Spotting Nation,
I mean,
doesn't do such things.
No, I don't think
just
they do.
Watch movies.
With that said, let's move on to the results. Are we going to live in a Star Wars-less universe, Josh?
We are. There will be no more talk of power converters, as scintillating as that is to you, Adam. 46% of the vote went to Star Wars, which means Godfather Part 2 won 54%.
So, pretty close. Here we go. Matchup number four, Citizen Kane versus Raiders of the Lost Ark. Kane beat Born on the 4th of July from Oliver Stone in round one and Jaws in round two. Raiders beat The Exorcist in round one and, oh my, a film I love so much, Chinatown.
So these are two heavyweights going at it here.
Yep.
Christopher Redman said, Rosebud is cinema's great lost ark, and I'll be damned if it will be lost to history by a khaki pants wearing thief. If Gen Xers screw this one up, I'll whip all your asses.
Okay.
This became a generational
conflict. The gauntlet has been thrown down. Eddie in Reseda, California. Let's get rid of this millennial bias. I'm 22 years old, and Kane is delicious. And if it's a vegetable, it's grilled onions on top of a fantastic steak.
Nice, Eddie. Rob in Bourbonnais, Illinois. If we consider Citizen Kane and Orson Welles as the teachers of modern cinema, I present this. If the student never surpasses the teacher has failed. I appreciate Kane as the masterpiece it is, but if these are the only films left, I want the fun and excitement of Raiders.
Okay. You can have your ice cream, Rob. Michelle from Ottawa. Actual quote from my mom when I told her how tough I found this matchup to be, but Raiders is the Citizen Kane of movies. Sure. I voted Kane. Sorry, Mom and Michelle. A majority of listeners voted with you, 53% to Raiders 47%. Again, a close one.
Goodbye, Raiders.
But a decisive victory. We're going now to the film that beat Citizen Kane, Josh, in the recent Sight and Sound Top 100 Films of All Time.
That's right. Poll. Knocked it out of its spot.
In 2012, Vertigo. Alfred Hitchcock's Vertigo beat Say Anything. Okay, maybe not too tough in round one. Annie Hall in round two.
Impressive.
And its contender here, Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, took down your beloved Umbrellas of Cherbourg in round one and The Shining in round two.
Rob Anderson from Waltham, Massachusetts, said this contest is playing out in such a way that the results are more representative of the lack of important films in the pantheon than which of these films is truly the greatest.
I think that's a shot.
Where is To Catch a Thief, North by Northwest, Rear Window, or Rebecca? All superior films, in my estimation, to Vertigo. Vertigo, while a Hitchcock classic, is deeply flawed in the same way its main character is deeply flawed. The relationships between men and women are cerebral, solipsistic, and ultimately unconvincing. Eternal Sunshine, on the other hand, is a deeply visceral examination of a romance that, despite using an element of science fiction as a core plot device, shows us how people react in the real world to the damage that love causes. Eternal Sunshine is sexual, where Vertigo is sterile.
That's deep, Rob, and well said. I haven't seen To Catch a Thief, so I can't really weigh in there. And Rear Window might be the equal to Vertigo. I think you probably prefer it. I would prefer Vertigo just slightly over it. But I'm sorry, there's no way North by Northwest or Rebecca are better films than Vertigo. So, Rob, we're just throwing out everything you wrote there.
I would think To Catch a Thief is the weak link in that argument.
Probably.
I mean, he's pushing his luck there.
Okay. So we've established that. Amanda King in Columbus, Ohio says, this was actually the toughest call for me in this week's round, but I quickly clicked Eternal Sunshine because, one, it's a great film, and one of, if not the most interesting film made in the 2000s, and two, the remaining bracket is looking like a bit of a boys' club, and I needed to rep a strong female character here. Film Spotting Nation, I'm so disappointed that you have left us with no David Lynch films. Who are you? I'm with you, Amanda. I'm so with you right now.
Stuart Feldstein, the matchup is almost perfect. Two men searching for second chances, one lost in his memories, the other trying to hold onto his memories before they disappear. It's almost as if you planned this. In the end, it's no contest. Sunshine can't hold a candle to the greatness of Vertigo, but it seems the weight of opinion is against me. I can't take all you commenters to a dress shop and remake you in my image of what you should be. So I'll just stay in my bell tower looking forlornly over the edge where you pushed Vertigo to its death.
No, Stuart.
Didn't happen.
No, hang on. You have hope.
Vertigo prevails with 53% of the vote to Eternal Sunshine's 47%.
Okay. So if you can get over that, you 47%ers, because we know how much that crushed you, we'll get to our upsets. Matchup number six, Goodfellas versus Pulp Fiction. Goodfellas beat Steven Soderbergh's Out of Sight and then Reservoir Dogs to get here. Pulp Fiction took down Cool Hand Luke and Rio Bravo in round two. We heard from Anthony Miglieri in Muncie, Indiana. If I knew my life would never again include seeing a majestic push-in of Robert De Niro coolly smoking a cigarette to Sunshine of Your Love, or an extreme close-up of Pauly lovingly slicing garlic with a razor, or a freeze frame of a hapless mailman having his head forcibly inserted into a pizza oven, well, that is a life I would not care to continue living. So Anthony's going, maybe not surprisingly, Anthony Miglieri, you're going with Goodfellas.
Here's Christopher Redmond again. When in doubt, go with cultural relevance. Goodfellas may have been underappreciated when it came out, but Pulp Fiction has withheld its iconic stature for over 20 years. C'est la vie, say the old folks. It goes to show you never can tell.
Ryan from Seattle says, sweet Jeebus, don't make me choose. Layla versus Mizzer Lou. And I had to look up what Mizzer Lou is. It's that Dick Dale song that everyone thinks of from the beginning of Pulp Fiction. Spider versus the Gimp, dueling Sam Jacksons, heroin versus a nice marinara, impossible. While I cherish the memory of seeing Pulp Fiction for the first time, probably the most fun I've ever had in a theater, and its lines, characters, and soundtrack have permanently nestled themselves into my DNA, it does not consistently deliver the way Goodfellas does. The masterful pacing and camera work and Ray Liotta's voiceover lock me into the Goodfellas ride on each viewing, no matter how familiar I am with its every beat. I can remember the way Pulp Fiction made me feel, but Goodfellas makes it feel like the first time, every time. Now go get your shine box.
So this one,
I wish that's how this one played out, but
this
no.
One's a puzzle to me. 61% for Pulp Fiction.
61.
To 39% for Goodfellas. What's going on there?
I don't know.
Scorsese was doing fairly well in the tournament, did really well, surprisingly well to me, last year in the director's edition of Film Spotting
Madness.
He's
gone completely now.
I know.
Raging Bull is gone. Taxi Driver, gone. And Goodfellas, the one that probably had the best shot of going all the way.
Probably.
It's out. Wow. Matchup number 7, Apocalypse Now versus Empire Strikes Back.
So Apocalypse Now beat Sam Raimi's The Evil Dead in round 1 and then went on to take down All the President's Men in round 2. Empire took out Nightmare on Elm Street in round 1 and then Singin' in the Rain in round 2. Steve Kimes, to quote the asteroid monster whose voice cannot be heard in space. Well, we can't really say anything then. Adam Fromm, he's in Providence, Rhode Island. I went into this round of madness promising to adhere to a few tenets of fairness and decency. No voting in matchups where I haven't seen the candidates, no ignoring my gut in favor of critical acclaim, and most importantly, no spite ballots, voting out of vengeance instead of love. Given all of that, this round should be a gimme. I have no attachment to Apocalypse Now, and the Star Wars trilogy was my first intense taste of fandom and very much part of my pop culture DNA. But Dag Flabbitall, Singin' in the Rain, has fallen far too young at the hands of the dark side, and Lord Vader must pay for what he's done. I've clearly become all that I despise in film criticism, but my vote represents Don Lockwood and Kathy Seldon spitting in Vader's pasty, plague-ridden face with their dying breath. And not being able to look at myself in the mirror is a small price to pay for justice. I'm a terrible person. Carry on, soldier.
So really, Film Spotting Madness has brought out the worst in people. It's almost like we've entered the heart of darkness.
I think so.
We've all become our own Colonel Kurtzes. Frederick in Gothenburg, Sweden says, hang on, let's assume Star Wars disappears forever. Does it remain gone if Empire wins? Shouldn't it at the very least return from the netherworlds of the Force, surrounded by a blue buzzy shimmer? I don't know why I'm asking, as I'm voting against both movies. With all of Star Wars gone, Spaceballs will take its place in cinema history. Finally, the Schwartz awakens.
Unfortunately, or perhaps fortunately, Spaceballs goes too. Okay.
So Star Wars is out,
back,
but
wins with 53% over Apocalypse Now, 47% of the vote.
So this was the biggest upset of this round, certainly based on seeding, but not surprising. We did have Apocalypse Now at number 3, and I say we being me and Sam. The Empire Strikes Back was the 14 seed. So
was it really?
14 taken down to 3 here in Film Spotting Madness. Our final matchup, Taxi Driver. Here we go. I guess I spoiled this, didn't I?
Yeah, a little bit versus Casablanca.
I really should prepare better. Taxi Driver versus Casablanca. Taxi Driver beat Midnight Run in round 1 and Mulholland Drive. Casablanca beat Edward Scissorhands in round 1 and Blue Velvet. So these two films took down my beloved David Lynch movies.
Yeah.
And
did you do some spite voting
out of
here?
Protest, I didn't vote for either of these films.
Come on.
No, I just shouldn't have. We heard from Jesse Rivers in Mobile, Alabama. Taxi Driver has been my favorite film since I saw it 20 years ago. It's difficult to imagine a world without it, but I'm a humanist and I'm voting for Casablanca for the good of mankind. How can we deprive future generations of the greatness that is Bogart and Bergman delivering that wonderful dialogue? Casablanca is the reason that movies exist. I already hate myself for doing this, but I'll take a bit of solace in knowing that Goodfellas has a chance to make it to the finals or not. Sorry, Jesse.
Michael Locker in El Cerrito, California said there are a lot of ways to navigate a Film Spotting Madness crossroads. Here's one. Plain and simple, which movie lingers more persistently in the brain? Not which is a better time, which has a more memorable soundtrack, which will my kids like more, or which casts a bigger shadow in film history. No. Just an honest, truthful assessment between two given touchstones, which is more likely to invade my thinking, which cut a deeper, more indelible groove in my gray matter. I enjoy Casablanca and admire it. I understand why it's beloved. It's charming. It's poignant. It's beautiful. I'd hate to part with it, but does it resonate in my thinking the way Taxi Driver does? Maybe Taxi Driver has an insurmountable leg up simply because, unlike Casablanca, it directly references a world I recognize. It might be 4 decades old, but it still feels like a genuine meditation on modern life. Spend time alone in a big city without a ton of cash, and it's hard not to relate to the haunted atmosphere Scorsese evokes. It's just a frightening enough collision of economic, sexual, racial, and political anxieties to feel even more spooky in 2017. They're both wonderful movies, but I'm going to pass on the comfortable chestnut this round. My vote goes to the menacing art film which haunts my dreams.
So well said, and I'm with you, and that's why I actually did vote for Taxi Driver, but it doesn't matter.
It
no
doesn't
suspense
matter.
Here.
Casablanca, 53%. So a close one, but the classic taking it.
Yeah, maybe it is that desire here as everyone's feeling so terrible about themselves, making these difficult choices, going against maybe their initial instincts in some cases, or going with their, let's say, baser instincts in their choice. They needed that warmth. They needed that comfort of Casablanca over Taxi Driver. So your elite 8 are The Godfather and The Godfather Part 2, Casablanca, Citizen Kane, 2001 A Space Odyssey, Pulp Fiction, Vertigo, and The Empire Strikes Back. So if you're tallying up the directors here, Coppola, Kubrick, Curtiz, Wells, Hitchcock, Tarantino, and Irvin Kershner.
Yeah, well, that happens with Empire.
Yes, it does. Empire is the only one of the films that doesn't appear in Sight and Sound's top 100 films of all time.
Okay.
So I guess you could charge us and our listeners with picking a fairly pedestrian list of classic films. Empire also the only one not in our top 10 seeds. So Empire, ladies and gentlemen, has now become your new Cinderella.
It's our Bill Murray.
Before we get to the next round of matchups, we do have to look at our brackets, and this will be fun because, as you've suggested, you haven't been following along. You haven't been crossing off your picks.
You are discovering this now.
Oh, you should be worried.
What?
You should be very worried. I told you last week you had nothing to worry about.
Yes.
Because you, me, our producer Sam, and Mike Merrigan, who was the inspiration, the founding father of Film Spotting Madness a few years back, we do this competition. We try to predict how the bracket will play out, and the loser has to suffer by watching a terrible film. You were that loser last year.
I was. Ridiculous Six.
Okay. Yeah. The Adam Sandler movie. You watched it. You talked about it for a couple minutes on the show. We all ended up suffering.
Trying to get it into the pantheon ever since. Yeah, no one will listen to me.
Exactly. So I told you last week that we were both probably pretty good.
Right.
Because Mike Merrigan had Jaws.
He lost his champ.
Yeah. He lost his champ in round two. So how good could he fare?
Yeah.
Well, I'll tell you, as of right now, Josh, through three rounds, you're in last place with 62 points. But that's not even the bleak part.
What?
Okay. I'm in second to last with 68. Mike has picked better so far, despite the Jaws misstep, 74 points. And Sam Van Halgren running away with it, 81 points. Here's where it gets really ugly, though, Josh.
Mm-hmm.
Sam has all four of his final four still alive.
Okay.
Mike, his overall champ, Jaws, is dead.
Yeah.
But I think three of the four final four are still alive.
Yeah.
I don't know if you've looked at your bracket recently.
No, I haven't.
Or considered the impact of the results we just read.
No.
But you have literally one film left.
I have one?
One. We have the Elite Eight, the Final Four, and the championship match. You have one movie.
So am I done?
You can win.
Am I mathematically eliminated?
Not quite, because I'm right there with you.
Okay.
I also only have one film left, and they're different films.
Oh,
so
nice. Okay.
If you're paying attention, we're in a battle here.
Yes.
For last place.
Yes.
It's going to be me or you.
I don't want
without
to know.
Without a doubt.
I don't want to know, because I don't want this to influence my voting.
No.
So I don't want to know what your film is.
Although I'm not going to tell you, though you should know.
You know.
I do know yours, but that's not going to affect anything.
All right. Okay.
So it could break where both of our films advance. Wouldn't it be great if both of our films faced each other in the championship match? I'll have to look at the bracket and see if that's possible.
Championship match for last place.
I don't think that's possible. We'll have to see how the matchups shake out, but it's all dependent on how listeners vote, whether or not you finish dead last or me.
And we still don't know the punishment. Mike's got to...
No, so Mike did, though, send me over Twitter. We were talking about it. We said we need to decide on this pretty soon, especially as we are then going to be biased because it's going to affect us. And he did find a list of the worst films of 2016.
Okay.
And it's a good list of terrible films. And I've only seen a couple of them. And I thought maybe we'll pick the five worst that we agree on, and we'll put them over at filmspotting.net. And we will do that this week, in fact.
Yeah.
So if you go to filmspotting.net, look where we normally put our polls, the bottom right there of the main page. We'll put the four or five films we're considering, and listeners get to decide.
Vote on the punishment.
Yeah, which one.
It.
We have to see.
Let's do that.
Here are the final matchups. The Elite Eight, Josh.
The Godfather versus Casablanca. Citizen Kane versus 2001, A Space Odyssey. Godfather Part II versus Pulp Fiction. And Vertigo is taking on The Empire Strikes Back.
Oh, man. It's brutal.
Okay. I'm sick of this Godfather crap, for one thing. So Casablanca gets my vote.
Okay, Godfather definitely gets my vote. Not even any hesitation.
Citizen Kane versus 2001.
Lots of hesitation.
Yeah, so this is, I've already voted against 2001 before. I've come to terms with that. Citizen Kane just, it does sound so conventional.
Yeah.
But the movie is so much more than that.
Mm-hmm.
So Citizen Kane, it is. Oh, Godfather Part II. I was sick of Godfather, but am I really going to vote for Pulp Fiction? I don't want to see Pulp Fiction winning this. I like it a lot. Great film. Godfather Part II gets my vote.
Okay.
Vertigo versus Empire Strikes Back. Yeah, this isn't my favorite Hitchcock. So as I've been doing otherwise in the tournament, I'm going Empire.
Okay. We agree on The Godfather Part II. That's the only one we agree on. I'm picking
You're
that.
Voting over Pulp Fiction?
Yeah, I am.
And you're doing both Godfathers?
I'm doing both Godfathers.
Okay. You can't have them both, you know.
They were the top two seeds for a reason.
If they meet in the championship round, we don't just say, okay, this is over. We'll just keep them both.
I can't?
No.
It's not a tie?
No.
Okay. Well, we'll cross that bridge when we get to it. I'm splitting with you. I'm actually going with 2001.
Really?
Yeah, I'm going with 2001. And I guess there's one more we agree on. I'm sticking with Empire.
Are you really?
Yeah. I guess I just can't imagine a world without Star Wars. I can't, even though I've already kicked out A New Hope. And yes, it seems wrong that the original should be gone, and yet somehow the sequel exists. That's not going to make any sense to future generations who come across the one existing film, and there's no context for it.
Think of all the great prequel fan fiction, Adam.
We're doing a service, actually, Josh. We want to know how you're going to vote. You can play now at filmspottingmadness.com, or you can look for the link in our show notes for this episode. That's where you vote. That's where you can see all the matchups, the whole bracket. Do it there, filmspottingmadness.com.
Well, imagine if 1991's Beauty and the Beast faced off against the new live-action remake in a Film Spotting Madness style tourney. That would be an easy vote for me. I'll share some quick thoughts on Beauty and the Beast next, and we'll review the third film in our Agnes Varda marathon. One sings, the other doesn't. Stay with us.
Josh Gad's LeFou singing the praises of Gaston in the new live-action Beauty and the Beast. It stars as well the lovely Emma Watson. Josh, you took your family to see Beauty and the Beast. I knew that you would be in line. What was it, a Thursday night, 10 p.m.? You were the first people there?
Yeah,
or
went with the kids to the midnight show. Screw school.
Priorities. You're a big fan of the original?
Yeah, absolutely.
The Disney musical?
One of my favorites.
There you go. Belle, one of your, if not your favorite princess?
I believe I'm on record.
Okay. So then you must have loved
Belle being my favorite princess.
You must have loved this.
I think it worked against me, actually, because this is, it's fine. You know, it's not terrible, but it is so faithful, such a slavish recreation of the original, except for the fact that obviously it's live action, that it was really dull. And it didn't make any use of Emma Watson that way because she was – I've actually seen when we went to Disney World, it's been a while now with the kids, we went and saw one of the, you know, live action stage productions they do, and Beauty and the Beast was one of them. And that's what this was like. It was, you know, make sure you hit the beats, you capture the personality in terms of the performances so that no one will be too disturbed, right? So they came and they saw exactly what they expected, which I suppose is fine in that sort of setting at the theme park at Walt Disney World. But yeah, when you're going to go see something at the theaters, you want a little bit of newness. The Cinderella, you know, live action film we both liked,
yeah,
managed that. I think it was a very traditional princess tale in a lot of ways, but it at least managed its own personality, its own sensibility. And this just does not have that. There are actually, you know, lines of dialogue you would expect, the songs you expect, but shots and camera angles and editing beats that are drawn directly from the original. So it's really striking at how faithful, I guess, is the word that you might use for this. And maybe some people like that, you know, maybe that's all they'll need. But for me, I wanted something that was a little more interesting. I, as you know, am a huge fan of Maleficent, which takes Sleeping Beauty and upends it and completely turns it inside out. I realize they're not going to do those revisionist takes every time, but maybe a little bit of riskiness would go a long way. I will say that Dan Stevens as the Beast, there's some great creature effects in how he is portrayed, especially in the middle, and that that is interesting. I do think that Luke Evans as Gaston at least is having a lot of fun with one of the great Disney villains. But at the same time, his song is another beat for beat one. So you're just kind of like, yeah, I've seen this. I know where you're going. Okay, interesting that these are actors, but beyond that, not much here.
So maybe if you're me and you haven't seen Beauty and the Beast or really thought about it for a second since 1991 when you saw it in the theaters and you liked it, but it wasn't a life-changing event for you in any way, shape, or form. Or if you're my daughter, Sophie, 12, about to turn 13, who I don't think has even seen the Disney original Beauty and the Beast, maybe we'll have a different experience. Maybe not.
Have her watch the original, please. Don't follow your path of disregard the
She's
past.
Not reviewing
and go,
it. She's not reviewing it.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. Yeah. I mean, I would think you would still recognize the familiarity because it is so iconic, a lot of those elements. I'm the odd guy out in my house. It went over better with everyone else and the friend that we brought along. So I'm just being a curmudgeon.
Yeah, so you were the guy mansplaining to your wife and your daughters
to
why it
family.
Wasn't a good movie.
Now, let me tell you, family, why we just wasted $100.
Beauty and the Beast is currently out in wide release, and let's face it, it's made enough money already. But if you have seen it or you seek it out and agree or disagree with our takes, email Josh and tell him how wrong he got it. feedback@filmspotting.net.
Glissant sous les ponts d'Amsterdam, sur un bateau mouche hollandaise. Les éclopés de la baisse, nous les mamselles, nous les madames, les maladroites et les niaises.
Valerie Mares as Pauline, a.k.a. Apple, in Agnes Varda's One Sings, the Other Doesn't from 1977. Mares, yes, the one who sings in this third film from our Varda Marathon. A reminder that this marathon is brought to you by Mubi, cult classic independent films from around the world. Every day, Mubi's experts introduce you to a film they love, and you have a whole month to watch it. So there will always be 30 extraordinary films for you to enjoy. And listeners of our show get to try Mubi free for a month. Just go to Mubi.com/filmspotting. That's Mubi.com/filmspotting to redeem now. That's where you can watch this film, now available. You can watch the movie we discussed last week on the show, The Creatures, and some other Varda films, some feature films, and they have a few of her shorts, if not playing right now, I know coming. What I'm most curious about with this film, Josh, and it's a tough one to kind of sum up the plot, not that there's a ton of plot, but it's essentially over multiple decades a story of a friendship. These two women, Pauline and Suzanne, very different women initially, and yet they're bonded together, and that bond remains very strong, even as they change and the times change around them. When we talked about the first two films in this marathon, we remarked on how male-centered the films were, despite the fact that they were obviously directed by a woman in Agnes Varda, the director, main character of The Creatures, and all of the men. Certainly, they're not the only characters in La Pointe Court, but we felt like we get the male perspective maybe more than we get the female one. This seems to me the answer in some ways to those previous films. And we are jumping ahead again another decade, of course, from The Creatures, which I believe was 1966. I'm curious about your response to that difference between these films. And also, I just want to hear your general level of enthusiasm for the movie, because this is a rare case where I saw this movie before you and before Sam. And I had the reaction to it that I knew you were either going to love it or you were going to hate it. I didn't think there was going to be any middle ground. I thought this was going to be the first time where you basically said, okay, this is a film with very, very noble intentions that just doesn't quite pull it off. Where did you come out?
No, loved it. And I didn't realize that you had seen it first. I didn't realize Sam had seen it either till I wrote something and then noticed that he had a very positive reaction to it, too. This is, you know, it's hard to say the one thing that it does so well, but everything I think about this movie, I loved. There's so many elements that just you add them all up and you're like, what a great experience that was, whether it's how it uses music or this conceit of them writing to each other over the years mm-hmm. via postcard, which sounds like a very writerly screenwriter trick, but in actuality, for me, I thought made it intensely personal to hear their voiceovers and their actual voices expressing these things. Mm-hmm. The way it balances, as you said, two very different women to give a fuller experience of womanhood and motherhood and the romances they experience, but also the career questions they face, the background in terms of reproductive rights mm-hmm. and how this is decidedly one of her, at least of the pictures we've seen, more feminist works, but it's not polemical at all. I mean,
that's arguable.
Okay, well, this is what I was thinking. Here's a movie that's set at a rally for reproductive rights, yet I would not. That's not what I first think of, is that this is...
No. So I think about their relationship.
That's it. And here's how I would describe it. Like, Pauline is maybe the... If the movie had only been about Pauline, I think it would have been that track. Mm-hmm. But the movie is not about how we meet Pauline as a teenager and she saves the older Suzanne in essentially mm-hmm. by saying, hey, I'm still with my parents, but I know I don't want to live this traditional life. You're already at 22 trapped in one. Let's get you out of it. But it's not a movie about how Pauline has all the answers and goes on to show Suzanne how to live. It's really more about how the things she might not have figured out yet and watching her learn those things. Mm-hmm. She stays true to herself throughout the film, but you know, not in a way that the teenage Pauline would probably have plotted things out. And I think watching life hit them that way is really a joy. It's something that is beautiful, but also very sad at the same time. And the other element I wanted to throw out there real quickly, because it's maybe one of the things I like the most, is the photography motif that's woven throughout the film. The movie opens with these still photographs mm-hmm. of women. And then,
taken by the husband of Suzanne,
yes.
A very failed photographer,
yes.
Maybe not artistically, but commercially, certainly.
Right. And that's how they meet, is that Pauline wanders into his photo studio and recognizes
yeah.
Suzanne in one of the pictures
from her past.
And so that, not just Jerome is that character's name, mm-hmm. not just his photographs. I love how they show up in the final section too.
Absolutely.
But there are other elements where photography is used that's just a nice continuing motif. So you add all that up for me, and this is a movie that just felt warm and generous
mm-hmm.
and expansive while still having these really – I mean, you could also say this – we recently did our top five political resistance movies. You could make a case for it being, you know,
absolutely
on that list, but it doesn't feel that way in the moment or really for me afterwards. So I'm trying to get the vibes. You had less of an enthralling experience,
well,
I'm guessing.
I liked the movie too, and I liked it for really all of the reasons you expressed. And I think we can get into maybe my reservations. It's definitely a film that's a clear reaction to the feminist movement that was happening in a lot of countries in the 1970s, but obviously in France, specifically here, an après-May development post-May 1968.
Yeah, we should say that a lot of the action is before and directly after 68.
It is, right? So those student protests and all the civil unrest in the country, this film very much caught up in that, a response to that, but with a little bit of time too, obviously 77. So Varda isn't trying to make a film that's very much about that moment, but that moment with some perspective of those 8 years or so. But I think the politics of the film for me a little bit is what poses a bit of a conundrum for me in terms of my enjoyment with the film, because on the one hand, you can absolutely see it and recognize how undated it is, and not just undated, but how timely and universal it is, whether it's France or the United States, whether it's the 1970s or 2017, how timely it feels in terms of the issue of reproductive rights, as you said, women controlling their bodies, women being empowered, issues of class, I think, are very, very relevant here. And just this protest spirit, this revolutionary spirit that's in the air throughout this film, it feels very familiar, right? It feels very
sure.
vital right now. On the other hand, I don't think you can see it and not recognize how absolutely stuck in 1977 it is as well. And I'm thinking mainly here about the abundance of and unintentional, I presume, comedy of most of the music. Mm. That poor Apple and her roving band of hippies perform.
Je suis femme, je suis moi, ni déesse, ni diablesse, ni faiblesse. Je suis femme, je suis moi.
We get some of these scenes, Josh, the white flowy gowns, the sheet,
right.
The makeshift sheet as their backdrop behind them with clouds and rainbows, and they're swaying and swinging and singing lines like, how good it feels to be a big dream, how beautiful it is to be a balloon, a tree overflowing with sap, a rising loaf of bread, a cookie with a fortune inside, a field ripe for harvest. You see, she's talking about pregnancy. I mean, I'm impressed with how many songs they were able to weave the word ovum into. We don't get that very much in our contemporary music. So I love the spirit of it, but as I was watching it, as the film went on, and we got more and more of these scenes, I'm sorry, I couldn't shake the image of Christopher Guest basically casting Parker Posey and Catherine O'Hara and shooting chunks of this movie shot for shot, and it would be hilarious.
That's not fair.
It's not fair at all.
I mean, this is the curse of the 70s.
Yeah,
for
it
some
is.
Reason,
that's what I'm saying.
For some reason, the details of that era are still, and maybe we'll get to a point where we're far enough away, or whatever it is, where they'll start to be charming again. But that hasn't happened, right?
No.
And it's maybe if you live through it, I don't know. It would have some sort of charm, and certainly if you were personally invested in this sort of music or performance art, it would work for you. I mean, it didn't bother me because I've kind of come to terms with the fact that the 70s, when I'm watching a movie set in the 70s, made in the 70s, it's going to be awkward for a little bit. Okay, that's just how it is.
It takes it to another level, but yes.
No, I mean, here's the other thing is that it's not – here's where the balance comes in too for me is that it is not – it's certainly not making fun of those elements of the movie.
No.
But I don't think it goes overboard in being too earnestly into them because it always has Suzanne as the counterpoint. And so let's talk a little bit about the path she takes. After they meet early on, she breaks away from Jerome. She has two young children at that point.
The actress, we should say, Teresa Lyotard.
Thank you.
Okay.
And she ends up, there's a brief moment where she goes back to live with her parents on a farm. That's just brutal. That's why she left them in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
Eventually, she settles in at running a family planning clinic. Again, this sounds really political, but it's not. It's mostly shown as her job, a place she has found where she can contribute and do something that's fulfilling to her and provide a home and a life for her two children. Really, aside from the fact that, you know, it's late 70s and she is doing that as a single mother, she lives a fairly traditional life. She becomes rooted in one place. It's not like Pauline, who's this vagabond in the van. And so they counteract each other.
They do.
And you almost get the sense that Suzanne is a little amused, not as amused as you were, but a little amused at what Pauline is doing. So there's a deflation there that I guess helped me with my own sort of resistance to this hippy-dippy-ish, you know, 60s leftover stuff that does take a fair amount of the movie. I take it you didn't enjoy the music video on the canals of Amsterdam.
No.
Where the song is, I think, probably hits a record for the number of times abortion is mentioned in the song.
Not really. And in fairness, I suppose, to me a little bit, because it sounds like I'm being no fun here at all. After I prepared for this discussion today, I did go over to see what Ebert said about this film, just to see if some other critic had anywhere close to the same reaction I did. He gave it 4 out of 4 stars. So
he's
all in on this film, but he does talk about how Varda is always trying to stay in touch with reality and she doesn't fall for the stylistic excesses of big fiction films, but then adds that restraint isn't always evident in this film, which contains about 3 or 4 songs too many for its subject matter to support. So Ebert and I in line on that anyway, but I'm with you that I think the core of this film is about that relationship. And I think what really struck me, it was a perfect film to follow, actually, the movie we talked about last week, doing our top 5 Danny Boyle characters, T2. One of the things that didn't come up during our disagreement about that film, I was a much bigger fan of the movie. One of the reasons I was a bigger fan of that movie was because of how well I thought it captured the nature of male friendships. That felt so right to me in terms of those core relationships that go back to the time you're 5 years old. And now as someone in your mid-40s, those dynamics are still at play. I thought Boyle really got that right. And then this movie comes along and it's the opposite, right? Where it's the female version of that in some ways. But I think this movie has to be up there in terms of my favorite movies I think about as films that really get that right. The Life and Death of Colonel Blimp, maybe from Paul Pressburger, my other favorite film about friendships. But again, two men. You talked about the way they start off in this film, those two women, where the younger girl comes in. She's a high school student at this time, I think, Apple.
Yeah.
And
she's 17.
Yeah. She meets Suzanne, who's 22, and she's not in a good position, certainly financially, not in terms of her marriage, trying to be a proper mother to her children. And I love that she sees in Suzanne that she is a sort of victim that she could become herself.
Totally.
Right. And yeah. So she instinctively tries to help her, but it's also an act of self-preservation for her, I think, to try to make sure that she doesn't go down that path. But as the film goes on, we see their positions actually kind of reverse. And I think that's where a lot of the drama, not melodrama, but drama of this film comes from, seeing them split the way it happens in real life for so many of us, people you have that deep connection to, friendships going back to your youth or your adolescence, and somehow you come apart, and yet maybe you do reconnect 10 years, 20 years down the road. And one of the running themes we've had throughout this marathon so far is me wondering how many films Varda's films influenced. And without putting this in the larger context of all the films that came before 77 and the films that came after, how many films have we seen about female friendships that have covered this kind of dynamic? I don't know if they've done it as insightfully or as warmly, to use your word, as this film, or as thoroughly as this film did back in 1977. It just feels to me like another movie that so many other films have taken a cue from.
Yeah, and it is so thorough, too. I mean, this covers probably around 15 years, but so much happens in that time to these two women from, you know, spoilers, I guess, but there are marriages, let's say. Mm-hmm. There are other births. There are other relationships, and we feel the full experience of those alongside with them. Somehow Varda fits that in, and this is only it's about 2 hours. So
right.
So it, you know, is very economical in its own way. And I just wanted to return too back to this idea of photography, and you made me think about it when you're talking about Pauline's scene in Suzanne, what she could end up.
Yes.
I love how early on Pauline is asked to pose for one of Jerome's photo shoots. And he says it's not working. It doesn't work because it just doesn't fit his aesthetic, because
yes.
The majority of the portraits we see are, Pauline describes them as sad women.
Sad women.
Right? And she, not only is she not that, but she is determined never to become that.
Right.
So
she's too defiant.
She can't turn herself over. When she's posing even for his photos, it's very confrontational.
Mm-hmm. She's completely naked.
Yeah, that doesn't matter. There's no vulnerability there. She's the aggressor. And so I like how that is set up. And then that little sequence I mentioned in the farm, which takes up maybe 10 minutes of running time when Suzanne with her children moves back in with her parents. There are two odd instances, and I'd have to rewatch it to make sure, but it seemed as if Suzanne's mother, who is one of these sad women, she's a very unhappy woman.
Yeah.
The film almost has her stay still in the frame while other things are happening in a way that makes it look like another portrait.
Yeah.
And I think it happens twice, and that was just so, so striking to me. And then Suzanne meets – there are positive depictions of photography too. When Suzanne meets a potential suitor and he starts affectionately taking snapshots of her, a throwaway scene. But it's just a through line. And especially when we do see those original portraits that Jerome took that Suzanne has kept over mm-hmm. all these years at the end, even though she has left him far behind, you know, kind of brings things full circle. So it's just, the movie is so true to that sense of sadness mm-hmm. and women who have experienced that, but then also where joy is found as well. And the reunion scene that this movie ends on,
mm-hmm.
where Suzanne and Pauline have managed to get together. They've gathered and brought along some of their family members who are with them at that time. And there's this unbroken single take that just sort of floats among all of them. It's very hippie-ish, so I don't know how this went over.
No, I love
you.
It.
Good, good. They're just kind of
there's
laying.
There's no singing about
ovums. They're laying in the grass. I don't think there's an ovum song. And it's just a voiceover describing their interior states of being. And this is something that, you know, as I'm describing it, I'm like, that sounds awful because show us what they're feeling, right?
But she does that as well.
She does that as well. And the performances in that scene do it as well. And it's just, again, so warm and so generous that you feel, you know, you can leave these people now and feel as if you fully know them as much as if you had met them in real life.
Well, I think that end too captures, if you can say the movie gets polemical, I think it comes through in the sense that I feel as if Varda's intent, as best as I can determine it from watching the film, if anything, what she was trying to accomplish is what her leads at the end of this film suggest they might have accomplished. There's a great line where we hear in the narration, these two women had fought to gain wholeness for women. Maybe their optimistic fight would help others, like Marie, who's Suzanne's daughter, now grown daughter, who was becoming a woman. No one imagined it would be easier for her, but it might be simpler, clearer. I feel as if that's Varda putting in words and in the visuals of that end scene exactly what her message with this film is. She's trying to carve that path, I think, with this film. This is a bit of a training manual almost for how a woman could behave in society and maybe should in terms of claiming power over their own bodies and their own minds. So that's definitely there, I feel like, in terms of having a moral, for lack of a better word, on Varda's part.
Sure. Well, and I think the reason it doesn't feel like it's a moral is because it supersedes any sort of specific political agendas we may have encountered along the way. This is the larger concern.
Yeah. I think what also struck me and maybe disappointed me a little bit is coming off the last two films where we really saw a daringness and a formal inventiveness with the camera. And not that this film needed it, but other than the use of some of the photography in those tableau shots, it's pretty conventional otherwise
in how
it's rendered. But there is one great shot, and I don't know if this is the other shot you're thinking of, but this is where it got to me, the combination of the voiceover, the music, but especially the way the camera was moving. And of course, the way it's staged, because that's crucial to the success of the shot. It's when they're in Amsterdam, I think, and it's when Apple meets the love of her life, the future love of her life, Darius. And I think she's just having lunch, kind of killing some time with a bunch of women who have all come to Amsterdam because they're seeking an abortion. And she says in the voiceover, this is officially, that was the day I fell in love with Darius. But what mattered even more was the bond I felt with the women there, women like me. I still see their eyes. And in that moment, the camera is just very subtly panning to the right and moving in on these women, showing us their eyes, showing us their faces. And they are, in almost every instance, even when some women are moving a little bit or they're talking to another woman, it's very restrained. It's really almost like the camera is following along a wall of photographs, just like it is earlier in the film. And so watching those tableaus, you feel as well this real sense of melancholy, because when the voiceover is talking to you as if this was something in the past, with that perspective, those women in that scene become ghosts in a way, right? They become ghosts from her past. And then you start thinking not just about what happened to these women to get in this situation, and thankfully they're taking some active steps to try to right their situation, but what happened to them after this, right? We don't know. We don't get that. And that hole and that emotion really comes through.
No, that's a lovely scene. And the fact that Varda can balance all the things you're talking about with Pauline meeting this love of her life, you know, shows how much she's managing to pull off at one moment. And I think there's a phrase that comes along a little bit later, but it's this phrase, family of women. And that seems to also encapsulate what she is going after. It is primarily this friendship, but the friendship is also emblematic of a larger family of women. And that portrait shot you referenced is absolutely there to sort of capture that family in a single scene.
One Sings, the Other Doesn't is available exclusively via Mubi. If you see the film, and we hope you do, and agree or disagree with us, email us feedback@filmspotting.net. We mentioned this Agnes Varda Marathon is sponsored by Mubi. And one of the great things about the platform, Josh, is if you don't have time to watch these films, you can, of course, get them offline. You can download them and watch them. You don't actually have to be attached to the internet. So maybe you're on your commute or your at the gym, someplace where you're not getting a great connection, you can still enjoy this film. Because what seems more appropriate than Agnes Varda and, I don't know, running on the treadmill?
The gym.
I don't know why I went there, Josh, but MUBI has a lot of other films that might be more gym-friendly, like, I don't know, Lawrence Anyways from Xavier Dolan, Canada's resident enfant terrible, with his third film and its unyielding commitment to its central characters, transition and plight. It is perhaps his most accomplished and thematically rich film to date, and we can't argue with that because I don't think between us we've seen a single Dolan film.
I believe that's true.
That is something we need to remedy soon, but there are other films we want to highlight as well.
Yeah, MUBI also has a director's survey double bill. This is a double feature that's devoted to talking to the artists and craftsmen behind the camera and putting them in front of it. One of these is great directors. This one includes interviews with Bernardo Bertolucci, David Lynch, Liliana Cavani, Stephen Frears, Agnes Varda. Hey, there you go. Ken Loach, Todd Haynes, Catherine Briat, Richard Linklater, and more. And the other part of this double bill is Free Radicals. This one explores a less conventional set of filmmakers presenting a portrait of the philosophies and voices of the avant-garde.
MUBI, again, is a curated online cinema that brings its members a handpicked selection of the best independent, international, and classic films every day. Their curators introduce a new title and you have 30 days to watch it. You get 30 films, always available for just $4.99 a month. And as I mentioned, when you use their mobile apps, you can download films to watch offline. Film spotting listeners can try MUBI free for a month. Just go to MUBI.com/filmspotting. That's MUBI.com/filmspotting. And that's our show. Filmspotting.net is where you can find 12 years of reviews, interviews, and top fives in the show archives. While you're there, take part in round four of Film Spotting Madness, 64 beloved movies. Only one survives.
Elite Eight, right?
It's the Elite Eight. Yep. If you haven't already, check out the Film Spotting family of podcasts as well, The Next Picture Show and Film Spotting SVU. You can find both in iTunes or your favorite podcast app. Out in wide release, Chips. Back, you know, Josh, you remember this when TV was really terrible and there was a show about a couple of California Highway City Patrol motorcycle officers. This is the movie version of that TV show, directed by and co-starring Dax Shepard. It's got Michael Pena in it, though, and anything Michael Pena does is gold, so I'm seeing this.
This already came out. Didn't we already get this?
Nope.
What am I thinking
nope.
of? Or is this a reboot of the remake already?
No, maybe you're thinking of Starsky and Hutch.
Oh, that's what it is.
But no, this is Chips, a show I watched a lot when
Did
I was
really?
A kid. Oh, yeah.
I miss Chips. I'm sure you're shocked to hear that.
I'm not at all. Power Rangers, basically, see above. We could repeat a lot of what we just said about TV shows.
That's a whole different era of terrible
TV.
Yes,
it is. And I did not watch Power Rangers. Sorry. Life, also opening in wide release. This is the film about the six-member crew of the International Space Station, whose task was studying a sample from Mars that may be the first proof of extraterrestrial life, which proves more intelligent than ever expected. So basically, it's Alien.
This came out, too.
Yeah, it's Alien.
All of this stuff has already come out.
No. Yeah, it's just out this weekend. Ryan Reynolds, Jake Gyllenhaal, and this is what I do love about it. Second billing, actually, in the list of credits, Rebecca Ferguson, who was so good in Mission Impossible 5. I almost want to see Life just to see her in this, but I don't think that's going to be enough to get me there, Josh. Out in limited release, Wilson, the adaptation of Daniel Clowes' graphic novel. Of course, Clowes, the writer of Ghost World, Art School, Confidential, and more. And it's directed by Craig Johnson, who did The Skeleton Twins, a movie I liked a whole lot more than you. We both agree that Woody Harrelson is a national treasure. He's in the film along with Laura Dern. That's one I'm curious about. And T2, Trainspotting, which was covered on last week's mega show with Danny Boyle. If you want to hear Danny Boyle share his top five Danny Boyle characters, you should go to filmspotting.net or find that show in iTunes. It was a good one. Boyle was a fantastic guest. One more to mention, limited release, the new Terrence Malick with all the best actors in it. It's called Song to Song.
That's all you need to know.
It really is.
So next week, I'm on spring break.
Yeah.
I'm going to leave you behind.
I didn't realize that was possible.
What do you got planned?
Well, the great Michael Phillips will be in, and he can gloat here on air about the demise of Raiders of the Lost Ark. Our listeners will probably love that. We are planning on sharing some thoughts on Song to Song, which is a film that is, from what I understand, a love triangle movie. So we thought, in honor of its 75th anniversary, and maybe giving it an unfair boost in the last couple rounds of Film Spotting Madness, we would do a Sacred Cow review of Casablanca.
Very fun.
The ultimate love triangle film. And as we said, Song to Song may sneak in there. Who knows what other fun we will have. If you have any thoughts on this year's Film Spotting Madness tourney, You can leave us a short voicemail about your bracket or your toughest vote, and we may use it in next week's show. If you have any thoughts on Casablanca and why you think it is still 75 years later a masterpiece or not, you can leave that voicemail, 312-264-0744.
Film Spotting is produced by Golden Joe Dassault and Sam Van Halgren. Without Sam and Golden Joe, this show wouldn't go. Thanks to associate producer Candace Griffiths and the listeners of the Film Spotting Advisory Board. And special thanks to everyone at WBEZ Chicago. More information is available at WBEZ.org. We're still hoping to see some new reviews of the show over at iTunes. Take a few moments, leave a few comments. It does help us reach new listeners. Our music this week is by Mitski. It comes from her album Puberty 2. More is at Mitski.com. That's MITSKI.com. For Film Spotting, I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
Okay, I was wrong. We went long.
Yeah, I knew we would. Film Spotting is listener supported. Join the Film Spotting family at filmspottingfamily.com and get access to ad-free episodes, monthly bonus shows, our weekly newsletter, and for the first time, all in one place, the entire Film Spotting archive going back to 2005. That's at filmspottingfamily.com.